next question that I wanted to ask is, you seem to do a lot of work on these genome-wide association studies. And I was wondering if you could just give my readers and the listeners that might be listening to this a little bit of a background into how these genome-wide association studies came to be. And more importantly, how do you think they will transform our ability to treat neurodegenerative disorders?
Right. So the question about genome-wide association studies really comes from two aspects, which relate not just to neurodegenerative diseases, but more broadly to human diseases. And the first aspect is understanding what causes a disease. So for some diseases, very simple, an infectious disease is caused by an infectious agent. Think of cholera or something like that. In many other cases, though, a single cause is not identified. It's never really been identified. So the idea is that multiple aspects of our inheritance and lifestyle contribute to our risk of disease. And so the first concept really is that the heritable component, even in a complex disease like Parkinson's disease, is something that you can estimate and assay. Now, the second aspect that drives genome-wide association studies is the ability to look at those genetic variants on that in very large numbers of people. So you put those two things together, the ability to look at the DNA and the idea that there might be a heritable component, and that's how you get to a genome-wide association study. So to just go into just a brief detail on how those are performed. What happens is you collect people with a phenotype that you're interested in this case Parkinson's disease, people without that phenotype, in this case people without neurological diseases, and then at the same time you usually confront blood samples, make DNA, and then assay using a chip, a microarray chip, usually somewhere around 500,000 or more polymorphisms. These are called single nucleotide polymorphisms in the human genome. And then you look for whether those are statistically more present more or less often in the people with Parkinson's disease versus the people without Parkinson's disease. Then what you have then is it is really a map of where you're likely to inherit some of your risk of Parkinson's disease. I will say just a couple of things that are I hope are of interest to people listening to this. The first is that those are not mutations in the way that you might think of them in other contexts. So they're not single cause genes for Parkinson's disease. What they are is they'll shift your risk of getting Parkinson's within your lifetime by, let's say, 5 or 10%, something of that range. But of course, because we look at lots and lots of genes all at the same time, we can actually add those all together. We can get actually now a reasonable estimate of what your lifetime risk of Parkinson's disease is going to be. And genetics probably only, even adding it all together, only probably explains about a third of the lifetime risk. There were other things, including age, but also non-genetic factors, has to explain the rest. And of course, that's not addressed in genome-wide association. So for your second question, which is, what use is there? I mean, it's very nice to know that there is a genetic basis of a complex disease, or at least partially genetic, but what does it really mean for people living with these conditions? And the answer to that is a little bit more subtle, but I think very interesting, something we're working very hard on, which is, if you know what the genes are, either singly or in total, and you can organize those into biologically meaningful pathways, you can start to think about, well, where would we intervene with that in order to diminish the disease progression? That's really why we do these studies. And so, for example, one thing that we've worked on a lot is a particular gene called leukin-rich kinase 2, the protein kinase. And there is signal in the genome-wide association that suggests that might be a target in Parkinson's disease. So originally that came out of studies of familial Parkinson's disease, but seeing that it's been there's risk there in the sporadic form of the disease tells you that the drug
Okay, that makes sense. Just before I ask my next question, I was wondering if you could maybe move closer to the microphone or just maybe somehow increase the volume just so the recording can pick it up a little bit more clearly.
Sorry.
No problem.
Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
Okay,
so the next question I wanted to ask, which tails nicely off of your last point there, is I'm wondering how our improved understanding of these LRRK2 mutations that are associated with Parkinson's disease are going to improve our understanding and our ability to treat sporadic cases of Parkinson's.
Right. So, of course, with anything we do in science, we have to be aware of the assumptions we're making. The assumption that we're making, I think, with the rare cases is that they are related in some meaningful etiological way to the disease process that's going on in a person without a penetrant mutation. That's what we call the go-through family. So the real question is, so we know what the mutations of LRRK2 do, for example, in families. The question is, does that protein also play a role as a bigger sporadic disease? And the things that might support that idea is really clinical data. Clinical data tells us that the disease looks very, very similar in a family as it does in sporadic disease. So you have a very similar age of onset. You have a very similar rate of progression in those two groups. There might be subtle differences, but they're broadly similar. You even have very similar symptoms, so the same range of motor and non-motor symptoms that are seen in people with Parkinson's disease generally are seen in these families. So that clinical data suggests that the disease is fundamentally similar. The other aspect that supports the idea that there might be overlap is that there is a risk factor locus, so a region of a chromosome, region from chromosome 12, that contains the LRRK2 gene that shows up when we assay sporadic cases. So when we look for genetic variants in sporadic cases, we see that they are there around that gene. But those two, both clinical and genetic observations, support that there is a shared mechanism between the families with LRRK2 mutations and the broader population. Now, what's difficult, of course, at this point in history is, of course, that is a hypothesis still, and that has the ability to be disproved. So the only way we will really know if that's the case is when we get molecules, drugs that target LRRK2 and try them in people with, you know, both inherited and non-inherited forms of the disease. And if they work, then we can really say that that hypothesis is supported.
Okay. That helps clarify things. Thank you. The next thing is a little bit more of just basic biology that I think a lot of people now are coming to understand DNA sequencing a little bit better and getting comfortable with the idea of what it is and what it might entail. But I think something that people are less familiar with and that I was hoping you could shed a little light on is RNA sequencing. So could you just briefly explain what are the differences and the relative advantages of RNA sequencing versus DNA sequencing?
Sure. So if we go back to the early days of when the DNA was shown to be the heritable molecule, right? So way back in the day, it was argued about whether DNA really carries any information. Of course, with Watson and Crick, we started to see the structures, and it became very clear that that's the repository of the information that we pass on from generation to generation, and all animals, plants, bacteria do. The DNA, though, is essentially like a library that contains books with the instruction system. And of course, the library is in some ways a static. I mean, it's not completely static, but the DNA, your DNA sequence will be largely the same throughout your lifetime. In a given cell at a given moment, though, it needs to translate that information in this repository into something that it's useful to do. And in fact, the end product really are proteins. And so, just to put it in the context of what we were talking about earlier, I mean, we have a LRRK2 gene on chromosome 12, we have a LRRK2 protein. And if we're going to target the protein most of the time, that's where we'll design drugs. There are some exceptions again, but generally, we'll design drugs against the protein product of the gene. RNA is the intermediate. RNA is the intermediate copy of the DNA that is then translated into the protein. So it sits in this really important part of that information control in a cell. And we have been many years being able to sequence DNA. What RNA sequence does is tell us what the cell is using at that given time under those given conditions. And that can be done either in a tissue sample, in a brain sample, or it can be done in an isolated cell. In fact, now it's possible to do single cells one at once and sequence the RNA. So that gives us a very important set of information. It doesn't just tell us what the sequence of the instruction manual is. It tells us which part of that the cell is actually using at any given time. And it turns out to be a very interesting complex process. So what happens is when, let's say, a neuron is making a neurotransmitter, it will copy the gene from the neurotransmitter, but it'll do things like splice it up, add bits, take away bits, and those will be important, for example, in the final function of the protein. So RNA sequencing gives us, it's a bit of a snapshot, but it gives us really much more detailed information about what the cell is using under those circumstances.
Okay. My next question is a little bit off topic, but have you heard of the term the RNA world hypothesis?
I have, yeah.
Do you ascribe, could you briefly describe it? And I was wondering, do you share that belief?
Sure. So this is, one of the reasons we do science is to explain the world and to explain our place in the world. So, of course, one of the greatest ideas in human history is the idea of evolution, the idea that life has been on this planet for billions of years, likely. And that it's the form of life has changed over time due to heredity. And so then a very interesting question is what was the nexus of that? What was the first thing that we would recognize that life as life now? What was the very, very first thing that we could say has passed on information from parent to offspring? And clearly the complexity that we have now of a human being talking on the telephone was not the first form of life, but we know that definitively. So the question really is, and the thing, and I said this earlier, the thing that makes us all similar, all organisms on this planet similar, is that we all have DNA. And DNA, in a sense, is the molecule that is tracked through all of those years of evolution, passing information from generation to generation. So then the question becomes, well, where did that come from? And now we get into areas that are very difficult speculation. And I do have to acknowledge that these are things that, we can hypothesize, but they will be very difficult to finally prove.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the RNA as world is that DNA has a lot of unusual properties. It's a very stable molecule, which is probably why evolution has selected it for holding the static information. It also needs to be double-stranded, again, most of the time, there are exceptions. And then it has to pair up against each other. And there are people who have suggested that is a very unlikely event chemically. And so the idea is that actually the first nucleic acids that were formed were probably RNA rather than DNA. And certainly chemically, that was a little more likely to form. So this is where we get into real speculation. So the idea behind that is that in the primordial world, there are a lot of chemicals available, just like there are in the atmosphere now, just like you would find in, volcanic vents and those kind of places you see in the physical Earth. And that there were by chance, enough reactions that molecules of RNA would form, and some of them would be stable enough to template, so to make a copy of themselves, which initially must have been a very efficient process. But then that became codified, and that became life as we know it. Do I believe in that? That's a very interesting question. I don't know that I have a very strong opinion, which is unlikely because I usually do have strong opinions. And that's because, like a lot of things in very early evolutionary theory, it's certainly plausible, but whether it's testable is not clear to me. But it's a re- really interesting idea, and one that I hope someone really smarter than me one day can figure out whether to test it or not.
Well, that will definitely be an interesting experiment, whoever thinks of how to actually test for that. So getting back a little bit to Parkinson's disease, one project that you're a part of is something called the International Parkinson's Disease Genetics Consortium.
Yeah.
And one interesting piece of technology that's emerged from this consortium is something called NeuroX.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could just briefly explain it and how it's accelerating our understanding of neurodegenerative diseases.
Right, so I have to give credit where credit is due here. So the person leading that is a scientist called Andy Singleton. Andy and I have been colleagues and friends for much longer than it's so embarrassing to admit how long we've known each other. But he and his team were really the progenitors of NeuroX. And the idea that they had was, so I was explaining earlier that when we genotype very large numbers of people, some of the collections of samples that are available now are nearly a million people, so genuinely near population scale information. And when we do that, of course, what we don't do is sequence every one of the 3 billion or so bases of DNA, the single ACGT nucleotide. We would love to do that, but that would be very expensive. And just, you can imagine trying to store all that information computationally would be challenging. So we can get much of the same information, not quite all, but much of the same information using a small little DNA chip. It looks like a microscope slide. You could use fluorescent molecules to scan it. And those can be made, you know, by commercial sources for in less than $100, and I think in the range of about 50 or so. And so that technology really drives the ability to look in larger and larger sample series. NeuroX in particular has some very interesting decisions that were made in the design of that chip. What Andy and his group decided to do was include most of the known mutations that are associated with neurodegenerative diseases, so that's the NeuroX, and then many other informative genetic markers. And so what that provides somebody is the ability to rapidly look at a DNA sample and say, okay, so this sample has this mutation that we know is associated with this disease. And it does it for, you know, frankly, the cost is incredibly cheap. Much cheaper than trying to sequence all of those genes. And so what that has done is really kind of open and democratize many of these large sample series. And that, I think, has been at the heart of what we found across multiple neurodegenerative diseases now.
Okay, sounds like a very interesting approach, and I look forward to seeing what comes out of that and how it's going to actually speed things up for us. It sounds like it sounds very exciting. The last question that I really wanted to ask you is something that you seem to champion throughout your career, is this need for an unbiased approach to understanding diseases like Parkinson's disease. And I'm just wondering, how do you actually ensure when you're running a study that you've effectively removed bias?
So that, well, you just made me very happy. We have been pushing this idea that we should be, I won't say hypothesis free, I'll come back to that in a moment, but removing as many sources of cognitive and technical bias as we possibly can. Because that's where, why do we say this? And this really comes from an idea in human genetics. The idea of human genetics, at its heart, is to look in as broad a way as possible in the most informative sample that you can find without specifying ahead of time what you think you're going to find. So, for example, we're wanting to look at a family with Parkinson's disease. You could say, you know, the grandparent, one of the parents, one of the offspring has the same disease so that would be a dominant family. Where you would start there is by looking across the whole human genome and the affected and unaffected people in that family. And you wouldn't say, think this is going to be in something to do with the dopamine system. Now, you might be right one time out of a, you know, out 20,000 genes, but you'll be wrong more often than you'll be right. So the idea of doing linkage in a family or association studies with populations, which we're talking about with GWAS, is to not go in ahead of time and decide what you think it'll be. Look at all the data evenly, assay everything as equivocally as you can, and then say, where is the gene? Where is the signal? Where does it come out? And that requires you having appropriate techniques that aren't biased as best you can, letting go of your cognitive biases of what you think might be going on in the disease, and literally letting the data tell you where you need to go. And of course, you know, I think that came out of human genetics, and that kind of thinking is very much applied in the modern world. You know, when we think about how large companies, tech companies collect these data, many of those are just using data-driven approaches to you know, drive advertising to people, things like that. What I've pushed pretty hard is the idea that you can apply that thinking across different types of biology, and particularly biology that we're interested in, which is things like how proteins interact with each other, how those interactions affect cells, can be approached in the same unbiased way. And so, you know, when we set up our studies, we generally use screening type approaches. And so what we do is we say, okay, what's the least biased, most coverage, most equivalent way that we can tackle this problem? And that's been very useful for us. And again, it's not quite a hypothesis-free idea, because you're still hypothesizing there is something to find. But it is making the hypothesis as broad as you can. And so what that has led us to is finding things that we weren't expecting. And that is a really useful thing, because then at the end of the, I mean, obviously, when you find something, you don't confirm it in additional samples and with additional techniques, and you drill down a little bit and make sure you were right. But what that has led us to do is two things. First of all, we found things that we really never would have expected, and that is really satisfying. And, you know, it pushes the field in a new direction several times. And the other thing is, it means generally, we've had a high hit rate of being right. And I don't say that out of arrogance. I say that because, you know, as scientists, that's really our measure. It's not about how excited the media get over a particular study. You know, is it reproducible? Is it solid? Is it right? Can somebody else build on it and move forward to what our collective end goal is, which is to impact disease progression? And so, you know, we found this unbiased thinking and technique to really help us build solid foundation for others to look at.
Okay, well, personally, I hope more scientists adopt it. It seems like a very valid way of validating the work that you do.
Yeah.
Okay, great. That was great. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Absolutely a pleasure. And if you ever want to talk about Parkinson's again, I do it every day, and I get very excited about doing it.